despair. He cursed the earth for spouting oil, black gold they called it, and he cursed the gods for not drying the oil wells. What did it matter that millions of barrels of oil were mined and exported daily, so long as this poor woman wept those tears of despair? What could he look into later? Could he make alternate land available? And would the lawmakers revise the laws just to bring a bit more happiness to these unhappy wretches whom the search for oil had reduced to an animal existence? They ought to send the oil royalties to the men whose farms and land were despoiled and ruined, but the lawyers were in the pay of the oil companies, and the government people in the pay of the lawyers and the companies. So how could he look into it later? He should have told the woman to despair, to die, not to live in death. That would have been more honest and respectable.
The voice of Ken Sarowiwa, reading an excerpt from his book, A Forest of Flowers. Ken Sarowiwa was a writer, a poet, and a playwright who became well known the world over for leading the Ogoni people of Nigeria in defense of their environment from the ravages of the oil industry. Ken led a grassroots movement whose success offered a template for people-powered movements across the world to fight back against the oil industry. He paid the ultimate price for his resistance. Together with 8 counterparts, he was hanged on November 10, 1995, after what many have called a mock trial at the hands of Nigeria's military government. Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast. My name is Sean Macheza. The story of Ken Sarowiwa has inspired activists in Nigeria and across the world. But while Ken's story is well known, it is but one of a myriad stories of resistance against the oil industry and against BP Shell in particular. Today on the podcast, I speak with Chihiro Helsenbrück and Anna Bisila. Chihiro and Anna are both climate activists and the co-organizers for the expo People Powered Movement versus Shell, an exhibition that explores the fight for justice that has been fought from Indonesia to Nigeria, from Curaçao to South Africa, and from Alaska to the Netherlands. Through installations, audio stories, photography, and relics of activism, the exhibition invites the public to learn from the people who have shown resistance and made calls for decolonial climate justice. I began by asking Chihiro to explain how the expo came into being.
So the expo is called People Powered Movement versus Shell. And that's really what we centered, the people power and the stories from our elders in resistance that sometimes we don't even know about in the climate movement. And I think is really part and parcel of the decolonial approach, is like know your history, because the present is oozing with the past. And especially when it comes to extractivism and the intersection of ecocide and genocide, we really need to work through those traumas and those uprisings and resistance together to have restorative justice. So I think as in general, as an activist, I've learned early on, like climate is so big, you know, the whole climate crisis. I've been taught, like, see where climate crime is happening in your own backyard and address that. So looking at the Netherlands, we see that Shell is really the biggest perpetrator of ecocide, so the structural devastation of environment. And it has had a long history in that. It's not just the last 30 years when climate got on the agenda. Shell had its history starting all the way back in the Dutch strand of it in 1890, when it was still called Bataafse Petroleum Maatschappij. And it was operating in Indonesia, which was then called the Dutch Indies. And so knowing that story or getting to know that story was very important to us, as right now Shell is facing a lot of court cases, both over the excess of human rights violations in Nigeria or other places, as well as climate cases. And we wanted to extend the sense of justice as practice, to look at the people that have been fighting injustices before in different places around the world, and do that through a lens of artistic, creative expression, where it's not just about the information, but it's also about activist pride or collective mourning, our losses and extinction, and having space for some emotional engagement.
And what are some of these crimes that you're highlighting that you've put forward in the expo?
Yeah.
What is the story of Shell?
It's not just the stuff that comes at the tank station to make your car go. So one thing, how we opened the expo is with kind of a meta view on Earth as crime scene. And this is an installation with a big tub of Earth with a world map on it. And from it springs a lot of red lines that have been crossed, red lines like a crime scene investigation with snippets of news in it, news that come from either research papers or newspapers that kind of tell different moments of Shell crime. And in the later years, a lot of that Shell crime is reported, such as pollution, like having impact on whales, or having impact on fish, or having impact on poisoning people to death because of their drinking water being polluted. But we also wanted to look at before the pollution of environment, or before the disruption of atmosphere, there is a moment of invasion. And that moment of invasion also is done with either police violence, military violence, political imposition, or expropriation of land. And we wanted to see what these stories look like, both in Indonesia, which was less known to us. We just knew that that's where it started. And in like Curaçao, where a major refinery has been, kind of the equivalent of our Rotterdam port, has been in Curaçao for a long time, since 1918. So the end of the First World War, it's been, Shell has operated there for over 50 years. And so that's where we really started looking, and what we found were both incidents of severe racist policies, environmental racist pollution. So that means that the pollution really goes to the neighborhoods of people of color, and white communities are not as much burdened by the pollution or the downstream of their production.
Racialism and imperialist colonial thinking seem to be hard-baked into Shell's DNA. And in apartheid South Africa, much of what is detestable about Shell's activities came together in one space. Anna explains Shell's particularly egregious acts in South Africa.
Yeah, in South Africa, many of the points that you brought forward were really visible. For instance, we could find in some of our during our research that you could see even in the organization of spaces owned by Shell, that the apartheid rulings were also applied. We, for instance, found a piece of documents explaining that African miners were in the lower village part, that is situated near slurry dumps and close to their operations, so really exposed to air pollution, to soil pollution. But in comparison, the white employees of Shell or people living around the facilities of Shell were more protected. Their organization would really show that the repeat what the system in place applied as racist rulings. You can also see that in the health of people, that black people would be way more impacted by cancer or asthma, and that they would suffer directly for air problems. And yeah, infrastructure and space organization really are good examples of how Shell replicated the apartheid rulings.
So Shell really had an apartheid, internal apartheid system also.
Yes.
For their own workers. What would you say for someone who would say, well, didn't every company have that at that time in South Africa?
I would say that it is true, but that the issue with Shell is that they did it in a sort of hidden way. They would act as if they were respecting the boycott of South Africa and Rhodesia, mm-hmm. when the international community and the UN formally asked people to stop doing business with the country until this ruling was taken over. And what we know is, yes.
Can I jump in here as well? Because I think a crucial element for an oil company, I mean, oil has been the leading cause of armed conflict for a long time, or like a causal agent for in warfare and everything. So if you talk about an apartheid regime and oppression, then you know, tanks don't run so well without fossil fuel and a lot of other operations. So if you think about every oppression, systemic oppression is backed up by military, and military is kind of dependent on oil reserves. This also played a major role in the occupation of Indonesia during the Second World War. Then Shell has a particular kind of lever function if it not just supports apartheid, but also really is part and parcel of a racist worldview. Like, they were proud to have segregated toilets, to have luxury toilets for whites only in their facilities. It goes pretty deep. And it's also in Indonesia, we also see racism actually being the first reason to fight back.
Yeah. So Shell was indeed sort of an agent for this white supremacist regime in South Africa. And I know, for instance, as a Zimbabwean myself, that Shell was involved in sanctions busting for the Rhodesian government of Ian Smith. And actually one of the biggest bombings in Harare, where in 1978, when the Shell depot was bombed by the freedom fighters. So even then people knew that Shell was an agent for this oppressive regime. Someone also mentioned to me that when the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa asked corporations to make presentations to them about their behavior during apartheid, Shell refused to to engage with the commission. So that seems to be indeed, that was their mindset even from back in the day. But did that change, though?
I don't think so. I think it's been quite consistent. If you look at, their founding story in Indonesia, I'd love to kind of jump and segue into that, because today Shell is the biggest multinational of the Netherlands. But how did they get started? Like, how did they get their starting capital? And this is a story of expropriation, colonial expropriation of the resources in Indonesia. And to today, we see a narrative of discovery of oil in Indonesia, when Indonesia already had, was very much aware of its oil and used it already since the 17th century. Of course, it's been industrialized, but it wasn't so much a story of discovery, but just expropriation. And so what one thing that I've read, especially like in the 40s, the Japanese, they when they occupied Indonesia, their main concern was the oil fields, because Japan didn't really have oil. And for warfare, oil, like discussed before, is such a crucial fuel to engage in war. Under the Japanese occupation, it was the first time that the people in Indonesia, I mean, that wasn't a joke. It wasn't fun in any sense, but it was the first time that Indonesian people also saw that this white supremacy was actually overrun in a way. Mm-hmm. And so after the Second World War, when Indonesia declared itself independent and the Dutch didn't accept that and kind of continue to oppress Indonesia, the struggle of the workers, who in many documents are described as either free or contracted coolies. So this was already quite a oppressive labor relationship. They described that one of the major critical issues that triggered dissatisfaction amongst the Indonesian workers was racial discrimination inside the company. And they called the Dutch sombong, arrogant. And there are particular cases where also names are being named, like J.M. van den Berg or J.F. Lankau, and incidents of how Indonesian workers felt humiliated by them or seeing that they despised the Indonesian employees. And that also manifested, of course, in not paying them well and not having sufficient leave. Like, days were long and hard. They started at 6 o'clock in the morning, 6 days a week. So it was that white supremacy manifested both in a hierarchical structure of how labor was organized, but also in the racial tensions of wanting a free and independent Indonesia. And when we see that when Indonesia finally achieved its acknowledged independence by the Netherlands in 49, the condition was a major reparation payment of Indonesia to the Netherlands for the Dutch losses.
So the Indonesians had to pay the Netherlands for their own independence.
Yes, major money, four point something billion. I don't know by heart, but it was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And it has spent paying up until recently. Like, I heard like some payment were still made in 2002. I read in some article, but I also know that in between, at some point, payments were stopped. But a lot of money has been coming from Indonesia after its independence still to the Netherlands, to the equivalent of the Marshall Plan money that often is quoted, that the Netherlands, after the Second World War, rebuilt with the Marshall Plan money. Actually, that money was coming from Indonesia. But we see a similar thing about how when Shell was finally had to leave the Indonesian plants, they made Indonesia pay for oil exploration rights. So the Indonesians had to pay for their own oil exploration rights in a similar fashion. And another thing that was super, I think one of the things that I learned from doing research into this was, in 1899, the Dutch government enacted a law requiring that foreign oil companies established Dutch or Dutch-based managers for the operations in the Netherlands East Indies. So this law made foreign companies not really able to enter Indonesia, which, you know, it was... You know, America wanted to get in there, the U.S., France. And so this law made it that Shell could actually start assimilating different companies that were already active in the Indonesian.
So they made it their exclusive territory.
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. And a similar thing had happened in Nigeria under British rule. The British bought all of Nigeria. And then also instated a law that made it necessary for oil exploration to be a British organization. Mm-hmm. And so Shell is a merger of a British branch and a Dutch branch in 1907. And so it had it two ways in that sense that it could monopolize due to colonial rule to expropriate the resources of that area at the expense of locals and the local environments, of course.
So you can, would you say then Shell has been an agent of the colonial enterprise? I mean, the Netherlands and Britain are in the top five, at least, of the colonial powers. And so that confounding, that joining of the colonial power and economic power that comes with the corporation has been very effective in getting them all across the world and to extract materials from all the colonized spaces.
For sure, for sure. I mean, the UK extended to a quarter of all land masses around 1918. So imagine, you know, like 25% of all land was UK. Netherlands wasn't as vast in land, but it was as super vast in its so-called trade, which was, of course, colonial expropriation. And the resources that we've gotten from Indonesia, I mean, we're just scratching the surface in terms of recognizing the harm done in Indonesia by the Netherlands and the way it has, created monsters such as Shell.
Yeah, and these monsters have not only then gone out and extracted and consumed and destroyed away from the developed world. They've not only done that. Anna, you've done some looking into the activities of Shell that actually are now sort of either a rebound effect or when the trouble comes home. Can you tell a bit more of that?
Yes, sure. So I've been focusing on Ireland mostly. And there the issue is that from the 80s on, seeing the evolution of the oil industry, the Irish government really tried to make it easy for oil companies to come and do business there. So they went from giving them a 50% tax rate to in 1974, I think, to 25% in 1992, which of course is a sort of gift for the fossil fuel industry, but it didn't even stop there. They went as far as authorizing private companies and mostly fossil fuel companies to go and do research on a land and become owner of this land through a system called compulsory acquisition order. Mm-hmm. So what happened in Ireland is in 1996, the former company that was there, Enterprise Oil, found a gas field in the western coast of Ireland. Shell bought out this company in 2002, and while knowing that people there, so farmers, fishermen, and simple citizen who liked to live in a safe environment that still that is really luxuriant, they were complaining about this pipeline installation plan, and Shell was sort of legally allowed to ignore their complaint and go and bypass their consent thanks to this action order, acquisition order. So that's what I really feel that it is important to point out, that in the West, even though protests are ongoing, we really have to see them as anti-colonial protests, because the state facilitated access to a private company, which is the same that happened before in colonization when it wasn't imposed, if it wasn't even imposed. The same way the military get support from fossil fuel during colonization. Now the police is on their side and protecting their facilities instead of protecting the citizen complaining for their land rights. Mm-hmm. This, for instance, brought five Irish people to jail for 90 days in 2005. They are called now the Rossport Five for the city they lived in. And the only thing they didn't do right is not allowing Shell to let a pipeline be built in their own garden.
Wow.
So, yeah, literally in their own garden.
And similar stories are happening also in Canada, right? I know here in the Netherlands, in Groningen, you have the fracking that's going on there. That's been causing a lot of trouble as well.
Yes. For Canada, for instance, it's interesting because it has some similarities with Indonesia, in the sense that there is the Tautan Nation, First Nation, in sacred headwaters in British Columbia. They resisted Shell for 10 years. They did blockades, and this had been ongoing with elderly people, young people, women. So it's a real community building around saving your environment and your culture. And once they finally managed to take the deal that Shell get to start operations in their area, what happened is Shell asked them to pay $20 million to compensate the losses they had in researching this area. And the information that was hidden behind them accepting to leave the area is that in the deal they get with the Canadian government, they managed to forbid any other company to come and do research in this area. So it's always, even when there's a victory, it is still...
It comes with a price to pay, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. Even though you are not the person who did damage the environment or invade someone else's space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to add to that, in Canada, we see that the front lines are constantly... moving and extending. I mean, that's a symptom of colonialism, right? You constantly need to extend and advance the front line. But we see from the Tarzans that now the front line has really moved to the coastal gas link pipeline, where Wet'suwet'en are again facing a pipeline construction on their indigenous land, and they've been fighting it for many years. We see a similar case in Alaska, where indigenous people have to fight Shell oil drilling, and they did so quite successfully, but also part to them not being able to find enough oil in a certain time frame, so it became more and more expensive. And so we see that people power movement is very much needed, but also it's super helpful to learn that certain movement or certain tactics and strategy have also really cost the industry a lot of money, which is needed. And one of the cases where that was super evident was actually here in the Netherlands, where people engaged in mass property destruction of Shell tank stations to be in solidarity with the anti-apartheid struggle and say, Shell, you need to leave South Africa apartheid system. And at some point there was like 36 operations all happening at the same night, where they cut through the, where you take your gas for your car, like to cut the slangen.
At the fuel stations.
Yeah, and you have headlines. We saw the collages of activists who made collages of the headlines at that time. Of the major losses that Shell had through that, and. I know that today, in today's movement, We are very much pressured to be respectable all the time and think of peaceful activism as something that doesn't engage in property destruction. But it's really interesting to see how people power movements have engaged in that with quite some success in the past. And
in the same way that I would posit that Shell has destroyed not only property, but livelihoods and a whole lot of other cultural material as well. I'd like to, because just for the purposes of time,
yes,
you've just explained that, you know, the resistance against Shell made it bleed somewhat. If something bleeds, then it can die. When Shell collapses, when Shell is gone, which we hope is an event in the future, what does that look like, and what opportunities and questions does it give rise to? What would a future beyond Shell look like?
In regards to people and livelihoods, I think it is really important to see that we can heal from a toxic lie that these type of industries create job opportunities when they actually destroy livelihoods. Like, they've destroyed so many communities of their agriculture, their fisheries, their ways of living and maintaining themselves. So I see a huge flourishing of people being able to feed themselves again and have more autonomy over their land bases and land management systems in ways that are helpful and healing of the ecology and of the community. So this is definitely where I would start. I think it's a racist argument to say that the jobs that pipelines or extractivism creates are more important than the lives of Black people or Indigenous people who get destroyed by it, either literally by being poisoned to death or culturally in terms of losing their livelihood and their economic safety. So yeah, I think this is the first point of healing, that we become more engaged with land management systems that are healing and restorative for community and environment.
And I guess to round off from both of you, starting with Anna, what would be your message to those that listen to this podcast, and in general, what should we take away from this?
So from both the podcast and the content of the exhibition, what I really, really wish people take is the learning from our ancestors, wherever they are in the world, wherever they had to defend their land rights and energy rights and energy management, and to understand that if there's a system that seems to be imposed on us, we still have the possibility to do research and work on building new systems ourselves and collaborating together, rather than just accepting systems that are based on archaic colonial and capitalist perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And Chihiro?
Yeah, I really hope that people come to the expo and feel encouraged, you know, to live more aligned with their values and such, and you know, not be afraid to polarize. There is a good side and a bad side when it comes to oppression and destruction of Earth and our communities. So I think it's super nice to see that this resistance against Shell is so multifaceted. You really see the workers in Curaçao, you see artists in the Netherlands, you see activists of all shapes and sizes, indigenous from all over the world, who have been inspired by other movements as well. And I think that's really important to see how movement can inspire each other and build a better coalition work across different lines of anti-racism and environmental healing.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I mean, I have to agree. I think there's something in the air in general. There's an awakening. People are realizing that the world need not be the way it is. Mm-hmm. And the big pillars, such as Shell, that have been holding up the system that's led us to this precipice, it can be changed. It can be, we can do things different.
I would just like to finish with the words of Ken Sadoviba, Earth Defender from Nigeria, who was murdered due to the involvement of Shell 25 years ago exactly. And he said, we might have to bend the laws. After all, the laws were bent to drive us into extinction. And I think with that courage and that vision, we need to be bold and collective and also kind of really reform our justice system and our justice practices in the process of this struggle.
This is the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I am your host, Sean Macheza. Thank you for listening this far. Many thanks to my guests, Chihiro Helsenbrook and Anna Bisila, the creators of the expo People Powered Movements vs. Shell, showing at the NDSM Fuse in Amsterdam. Please check the link in the podcast description. Make sure to also listen to our previous episode on extractivism in North Africa, where Shell is intricately involved, as well as to our episode on the building of a pipeline in Salento, Italy. These and other episodes are available from wherever you are streaming the State of Power podcast. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you so much for listening and see you next time.
Ogoni is the land. The people Ogoni. The agony of trees dying in ancestral farmlands, streams polluting, weeping filth into murky rivers. It is the poisoned air causing the lockless lungs of dying children. Ogoni is the dream breaking the looping chain around the drooping neck of a shell-shocked land.